Welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. I'm not Jane Crowther, she's on holiday this week. I'm Matt Maytham, I'm the deputy editor of Total Film, and you could say the team's resident Christopher Nolan geek. And today I'm joined by our news editor, Jordan Farley.
Hello.
And our online editor, Jack Shepherd.
Hello.
This week, we're doing away with the usual format, and instead we're going to be ranking all of Christopher Nolan's films to date. And as a special treat, as the embargo is just lifted at the end, we're going to be doing a spoiler-free review of Nolan's new film, Tenet. So stick with us for that. But first, we're doing a countdown and ranking his previous 10 films in order. So let's get straight into it. Starting off the countdown at number 10 is...
Your eyes drift across a crowd of people, and they slowly stop and fix on one person, and all of a sudden that person isn't part of the crowd anymore. They become an individual, just like that. Just became irresistible.
You followed women?
I followed anybody. I just wanted to see where they went, what they did. It was supposed to just be completely random. You would never follow the same person twice. That was the most important rule. That was the one that I broke first. That's when the trouble started.
So at number 10, that was Following, Nolan's first feature. So Jack, set this one up for us.
So Following, it's about a man who's obsessed with following other people. He follows the wrong man and gets caught up in a world of underground crime. And then kind of from there has all the Nolan twists and turns you kind of expect. Not so much timey-wimey stuff, but a few kind of classic noir touches. What do you guys think of this one? It's been ages since I've seen it.
Yeah, it's been the best part of 20 years since I've seen it. I think I saw it after Memento, like I imagine a lot of people did, after being absolutely blown away by that film. And going back to Following, I did find it an interesting sort of curio. Like, you can see shades of the director Nolan wants to become. Like, you've got the sort of flashback, flash forward kind of structure is sort of happening in there to a lesser extent than some of his future films. And it looks amazing, of course. But I think it's probably right that it's in at number 10.
It's no shame to be at the bottom of a list of Nolan films, I would say. But yeah, this one is one that if you view it in context, I think it's a great achievement when you think it was done on such a micro budget and, you know, shot at weekends on a shoestring just when they had time to do it. As you're saying, you do see that kind of, you know, the early signs of that narrative invention. You can tell this is someone who's got talent. But like, obviously, as an actual viewing experience, yeah, it's kind of rougher around the edges than his other films.
It's only like an hour long, isn't it?
Yeah,
70 minutes, yeah.
I still really enjoy this film. I think, you know, talking with up-and-coming filmmakers, a lot of them do watch this film as, you know, inspiration, because it's one of those rare films by such a huge filmmaker now, which was, you know, as you say, shot on such a micro budget, you know, getting his friends together over weekends to do bits and pieces. And listening to Nolan talk about the way they did it, you can feel that he learned so much from doing this film and working within the constraints of that budget, because every movie he's done since, he's gone in under budget. And it kind of comes from this mentality of just keeping it cheap, doing only the shots that you really need to do. You know, it's almost a miracle that this film is as good as it is.
Yeah.
Because, you know, watching other films shot at this budget, they're pretty awful, most of them. And this one, it's held up even alongside, you know, something like Insomnia, which is perhaps, you know, Nolan's most straightforward film and has Al Pacino in it, you know, and this film isn't, you know, too much worse than that. It's not quite as good because it doesn't have, you know, all the flair and, you know, the cinematography of that one, but it's still a decent watch.
I would actually quite like to see Nolan make another black and white film. I know you obviously get the little black and white bits in Memento as well, but I think he could do something really stylistically interesting.
Yeah, I'd love to see him just drop a little film one day, just sort of out of nowhere, just in his, you know, backyard, he's filmed another micro-budget film. I think that would be super interesting. But
can you imagine if
he knows where he's done this lockdown?
Yeah, exactly. Can you imagine if he did a Zoom movie?
That's Following then, and we're pretty much seem to be agreed that's like a fair enough 10th place. Moving on to number 9, it's this.
Someone out there just beat a 17-year-old girl to death. Your job is to find him.
Doesn't say in the report that he clipped her nails. He washed her hair.
No mutilation?
Not this time. He tortures him, makes him do things, and keeps him there for 3 days.
This guy, he crossed the line, and he didn't even blink.
So that was Insomnia, which was Nolan's third film. It came out in 2002, and it's a remake of a Norwegian film that starred Stellan Skarsgård and came out a few years before. This film stars Al Pacino as an LAPD detective called Will Dormer. There's a bit of a clue in his name there. And he's sent to Alaska to investigate the murder of a young girl, which we discover relatively early on was done by a crime writer called Walter Finch, who's played by Robin Williams. And what really kind of complicates matters here is the fact that Dormer, during a chase, he accidentally shoots and kills his partner. And this partner was kind of someone who's going to testify against him in an upcoming internal affairs investigation. So everything starts to get a bit morally murky. And also you have the fact that in this particular town in Alaska, at this time of year, they get sunlight all day long. So that completely throws Dormer off his game. And I think this is a very solid crime thriller. I would give it 4 stars out of 5. You've got great performances, and this is Nolan after kind of making that calling card of Memento. He's showing he could attract and handle proper like A-list heavyweights. Like, his leading three actors were all Oscar winners, and there's some sort of nice set pieces, and it's sort of nicely done. But for me, I kind of would rank it down here at number 9, because it does just feel that bit more conventional than his other films. And also the fact that it is a remake, and I think it's the only film of his which he doesn't have any sort of screenplay credit, just makes it feel like a slightly sort of lesser entry in his canon. But what do you boys think?
I sort of see it as more of a stepping stone film. As you were saying, it felt like at that point in his career, he needed to slightly prove himself with bigger names and with a bigger budget. And it's this film that allowed him to go on and make Batman Begins and Inception and all these mega budget blockbusters. Again, I don't think it's a bad film by any stretch. A little bit of insight. I saw this film at my local cinema in Burnley in a double bill with John Woo's Wind Talkers, which is a film I was insanely excited about because I loved John Woo at the time. And this was the sort of, it's on at the same time, I'll go and see it. But I remember being a lot more impressed by this than I was by Wind Talkers, which is not the best film. But I remember just being particularly blown away by Robin Williams, because he was going through that stage in his career where he was playing murkier characters. And he is a real like piece of work in this film. It's really loathsome. And when you've spent your entire, you know, film watching life, seeing Robin Williams play these, you know, hilarious characters, it felt like a real shock to see what he does here. And you have to give a lot of credit to Nolan as well for even casting him in this role.
I have a confession, if we're talking about when we first saw this movie. I first saw it last night because I hadn't seen it before. This is like, because it is one of Nolan's lesser films, I feel like I've always just kind of put it off because I love his other movies so much, and I kind of didn't want to be disappointed. And to be fair, I wasn't disappointed at all. It's much better than some people have made out to be. And it's really hard to talk about a ranking of Nolan movies, because you have to put one above the other, but he hasn't really made a bad film. I thought it was a really solid crime piece. It felt very Hitchcockian in places. Definitely his most straightforward film. The cinematography was amazing. I guess the thing about time in this one was with the light and having to stay up all day. I would say I was slightly disappointed with Al Pacino's performance, which I know is a really harsh thing to say, but he plays the whole film being tired and morose and kind of like giving these long death stares. And by the end of it, I was a bit like, Christ, I just want him to like wake up and have like a really confrontational big moment with Robin Williams. Yeah, it could have been like this really explosive scene, but he's just so tired the whole time. Like, there's a bit on the barge and his head's just resting against this thing and you're like, oh man, I really want him to like slap him and wake him up.
But he hasn't had any sleep for weeks. What do you expect?
Can Nolan have just given him a week to just be like, right, you're going to have some rest tonight so we can have this big scene? But yeah, I haven't seen the original.
This is something I was just about to add, actually, because I actually saw it at the time, again, out of interest, just after seeing this one. And my memory was that it was vaguely more ambiguous than this one, because you do kind of basically end up getting a kind of heroic resolution for Pacino's character in the end. But my memory of the other one is that it was more morally murky, but I can't remember it all that well, so that might be me misremembering.
I might have to go watch that one. I would definitely be intrigued, because I was reading about it after watching it, and it was saying that, yeah, they played a lot more with making it a bit murkier. Kind of, they didn't have the bit where the cop Al Pacino kills is like investigating Al Pacino. So it sounds like it was, you know, playing a bit more with morality. Here it's a bit more straight-laced, I guess, and Al Pacino does kind of come across as, oh, he wasn't that bad in the end. He was just doing what he thought was right.
I find it almost odd to think that Nolan ever remade a film at this point. I can't imagine Nolan ever doing that now, just because he creates his own material. I mean, he's one of the few filmmakers that are actually left to get original scripts greenlit at a, you know, an eye-watering budget. It just seems remarkable to me that he would ever do this, but I guess that was the stage in his career and it's what he was interested in doing.
Yeah, so it is an oddity for that reason. And yeah, we again seem like we're all fairly agreed that that's a right choice at number 9. So let's move on. And at number 8, The Fire Rises.
Did they kill him?
I'm not sure.
Huh. Why didn't you just kill me?
Your punishment must be more severe.
Do you think he's coming back?
I don't know.
Why would you run, Dane?
You should be as afraid of him as I am.
I won't bury you. I've buried enough members of the Wayne family.
You don't owe these people anymore. You've given them everything.
Not everything. Not yet.
And so that, of course, is The Dark Knight Rises. Jordan, tell us about this one.
Yeah, so this is the third in Nolan's remarkable Batman trilogy. It's set 8 years after The Dark Knight. Batman has pretty much been MIA that whole time, but the emergence of Tom Hardy's Bane on the scene kind of brings him back out of action. He's at this point, he's effectively retired. He's got like a busted up knee and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, so a big part of this film is sort of Batman's rehabilitation. It's something that runs throughout the film. And then alongside this, you have the introduction to some of Batman's Hall of Fame characters, including Anne Hathaway's Catwoman and Joseph Gordon-Levitt's Redacted, although we all know who is really playing.
So do you think this is fair, number 8 on the list?
I think it's fair. Again, Nolan hasn't made a bad film, and I actually love all of his Batman films. The Dark Knight Rises suffers a little bit because it has to follow The Dark Knight, which is obviously completely beloved. And you can't help but draw comparisons to that film. In Bane, he's a really strong villain, but when you put him up against Heath Ledger's Joker, there's really no comparison. But there's a lot of really good stuff in here. I love the fact that for the first time in Nolan's Batman films, he's faced with a physical threat that he's really no match for, that he can't just rely on the fact that he's incredibly good at elbowing people in the head and has all these gadgets. He has to outsmart him, and he has to be the symbol that he's claimed to be this whole time. But there's a lot of really good thematic stuff running through this. And my favorite thing about The Dark Knight Rises is that for the first time in a Batman film, we get a final Batman story, because every Batman film up until this point was open-ended. You expected sequels. It didn't allow filmmakers to actually tell a story that put a full stop on that character, and that's exactly what you get here. And I think it's actually emotionally quite powerful. Those last like 10-15 minutes I find really moving, and there's a moment where him and Gordon in the tunnel where he sort of reveals his identity to him. And I remember just like, you know, welling up in the cinema at that. I was like, oh, come on, it's too much.
I would quote that line, but I will start crying now if I do that. Because, for me, I love all these films. And pretty much now that we've passed Insomnia, to be fair, all these films in this top 8, I would give 5 stars. And there's not a huge amount in it for me, but it's definitely the most emotional out of the Dark Knight films. Just that scene with Alfred on the stairwell. And yeah, those moments you've mentioned. So Jack, how about you? What are your thoughts on The Dark Knight Rises?
Yeah, again, it's by far my least fave of the Batman films. And I don't really enjoy this film too much. I find it way too long. And the stuff where Bruce is trapped in a hole and then has to get back out, it goes on and on for me. I get it, like rebuilding the character and stuff, but it just doesn't work for me. And I find without, you know, the Joker in it, it feels like Joker should have been here as well. I obviously understand completely why he wasn't in it, for reasons we all know. It does feel like there is something missing from this film. And it's still not a bad film. It's just not on the same level as the other two. And I think that's always, as you know, Jordan said, you know, it's got a tough gig to follow, you know, The Dark Knight. And I just don't think it really rises to the occasion as well as it could have. You know, it's still got really fun moments. You know, I enjoy watching Gotham in Carnage, that kind of stuff. I think you still need in about half an hour cut out of this film.
I mean, it does seem to be indulgent. The most divisive out of the three.
But it has got that incredible football pitch sequence. I remember seeing that in the trailer and just being like, oh my God, this is going to be the greatest thing I've ever seen. You might be able to confirm or deny this, Matt, but the Joker was supposed to be in it. Like, they did talk about the idea of him being in a prison cell. Is that true, or is that just an internet rumor?
My memory is that they've always said that he wasn't going to be in it, but I don't know for sure. I'd need to double check. And it's one of those things, I guess, we'll just never know, where we really would never know what it would have been like. But you kind of obviously, you know, after The Dark Knight, you do want more of the Joker, so... You can't imagine that he wouldn't have at least made an appearance.
Yeah. You can imagine, though, if he hadn't had a big role, it could have been slightly, you know, diminishing for his character in a way. I think almost like the legend of Joker, you know, coming in for The Dark Knight and then not being seen again. You know, if he was just a puppet for Bane or whatever, or, you know, running that Scarecrow run, it would have seemed a bit like lesser for that character. He would have needed to have like a bigger presence almost.
Yeah, he probably would have taken over the film if they'd have put him in it. So you can kind of understand why they might have wanted to leave him out regardless.
That was The Dark Knight Rises at 8. And blasting in at number 7 is...
We must confront the reality that nothing in our solar system can help us.
Now you need to tell me what your plan is to save the world.
We're not meant to save the world. We're meant to leave it. And this is the mission we were trained for.
I've got kids, Professor.
Get out there and save them.
You have no idea when you're coming back.
I'm coming back.
So that was Interstellar. Jack, tell us about Interstellar.
Yeah, this film's quite a hard one to explain succinctly, but I'll give it a go. So Matthew McConaughey's character, he's a former NASA pilot turned corn farmer living in a dystopian year of 2067 in a post-truth era. He lives with his son and daughter, and his daughter Murphy ends up with these weird dust patterns in her room, which McConaughey finds the coordinates to somewhere, and then he goes, presents this to NASA, and then there's revealed to be a secret base, and then they decide that they're going to go travel through a wormhole to go find a planet that's potentially habitable for humanity. That's pretty much the premise. It's been a while since I've seen this one as well, because I remember coming out of the cinema and being slightly disappointed. It's still such a great movie, and the space stuff's incredible. I think one of the things that I found slightly jarring, I don't know about you guys, there's like a cameo role in it. When Matt Damon shows up, it just really threw me, because I was like, oh, Matt Damon. So I had no idea. And then he suddenly appeared, and I was just like, oh man, this is really weird. Why is he in this film? And also there's like the twist at the beginning of it, which I think I kind of like had an inkling towards what was coming, because I'm always just trying to work out Nolan films before it happens. It's still an incredible space adventure, though. And I think I'm one of the people who is more damning about this than other people. How do you guys find this one?
Well, first, in counter to the Matt Damon comment, I would say, one, I'm just a massive fan of Matt Damon anyway, so I was very pleased when he turned up. And I particularly liked it because, obviously, I wasn't expecting him to be there. And then you do very much expect to see Matt Damon as the sort of straight-laced, nice guy. So I liked that they kind of played against your expectations, and they kind of needed that, because you kind of needed someone who felt initially really trustworthy. You're like, oh, Matt Damon, of course, I feel great that he's here. And then obviously it doesn't quite work out that way. I sort of love, as you're saying, the epic space stuff. I'm one of those people who'd argue that Nolan's films are more emotional than they're given credit for, but this is perhaps the most emotional. I don't know if there's an emotional moment that beats the one of McConaughey getting the video calls back from home when he's kind of gone through that time sort of distortion, and time on Earth has sort of moved on, and his son, who was originally played by Timothy Chalamet and is later played by Casey Affleck, kind of he's catch up on those video messages. And I find that bit just so heartbreaking, and just McConaughey's face in that scene in the close-up, like, I know it's kind of become a bit of a meme, but I still just find that like an incredibly affecting scene. Perhaps of all Nolan's films, for now, it's one of the most challenging when it gets into that final stretch. It's kind of ideas that really do kind of push your brain and your concentration span to the limit. But I do think it is rewarding when you go with it. But yes, Jordan, you're not so keen on this, are you?
Yeah, I'm really not the biggest fan. It's probably my least favorite Nolan film. A lot of that comes from my expectations for the film. I'm a huge sci-fi fan. I absolutely love 2001. So I was unbelievably hyped for this film. And a lot of it just really underwhelmed me. I think all the stuff with relativity and time, I think is brilliant, absolutely ingenious. The fact that, you know, the visual effects studio DNEG sort of used mathematics to map out a black hole. All that stuff is incredible, absolutely mind-blowing. But really, it just falls apart in the last 45 minutes for me when he enters that, you know, weird extra dimension in the black hole and he's behind the bookcase and it's all just so sappy and saccharine. And then you get like a happy ending and none of it rang true to me after something that was so like brutal in a way. Like you say, that Matthew McConaughey scene where he watches his children, you know, grow old in front of his eyes. It's just heartbreaking and you just really feel for him. But then by the end, it feels like you've been totally robbed of all that emotion. It's felt like a real cheat to me. But I've only seen this film once, so maybe I should revisit it and I'll reappreciate it.
Yeah, I think I'm in the same boat because I've only seen it once. 2001, there were so many comparisons made to it, you know, and Nolan since, you know, toured that movie and stuff. You want it to kind of be similar to that, but I guess Kubrick's film doesn't have that emotional pull, you know, it doesn't have the family element to it and things. And this tries to do something different. And Nolan rightly tries to do that, but I just don't think it's as successful as I wanted it to be, or Matt thinks. loads of people and I really, really love this film. And I could see why it's, you know, ranked higher than perhaps I would have it on this list as well.
I will say I really love Tars. I think he's one of Nolan's best characters. Great. He's awesome.
Yeah.
Can't believe they actually had like a physical Tars on set as well. It's just amazing.
So yeah, all that said, I guess your qualms perhaps hold it back from the sort of top half of Nolan's filmography. But yeah, so that was Interstellar. And next up, in at number 6, Are You Watching Closely?
Every great magic trick consists of 3 acts. The first act is called the pledge. The magician shows you something ordinary, but of course, it probably isn't. The second act is called the turn.
He's obsessed with discovering your method.
The magician makes this ordinary something do something extraordinary.
Huh.
Now you're looking for the secret, but you won't find it. That's why there's a third act called The Prestige. This is the part with the twists and turns, where lives hang in the balance.
Julie, come on!
And you see something shocking you've never seen before.
That was, of course, The Prestige. Jordan set this one up for us.
Yeah, so this is set in 19th century London, a bit of a change for Nolan. It stars Christian Bale and Hugh Jackman as Robert Angier and Alfred Borden, who are two magicians. At the start of the film, they're working for Michael Caine's John Cutter. They're working on this magic trick involving a water tank, and tragedy results from a trick gone wrong. And this results in Angier and Borden effectively being mortal enemies and embarking on separate magical careers. Borden, Christian Bale's character, develops this trick called the Transported Man, which is really what sets Angier off on this just spiral of obsession where he has to work out how he's done this impossible trick. But the thing I really love about The Prestige is that it's effectively a cinematic magic trick in itself. His filmmaking techniques are akin to sleight of hand and obfuscation and illusions. So everything about the story is layered into what Nolan does as a filmmaker. And alongside this, you have this incredible story driven by remarkable characters. Like, I love magicians and I love the idea of people who dedicate themselves to a craft like this. And Nolan really doubles down on character in this film in a way that he perhaps hadn't done up to this point. I really, really love The Prestige. I think it's probably one of the more underrated films in his filmography.
I would agree with that. It's definitely one of the sort of lesser talked about ones, isn't it? Like, what do you think, Jack?
Yeah, I really enjoyed this film. I watched it again in preparation for this. And even knowing the twist, you know, you're seeing almost like how the magician does it when you know what's coming. And you're like, oh, yeah, that leads into that and that leads into that. But it still holds up and it's still such an intriguing movie. It's shot so well. It's got amazing performances in it. Also, the cast is just stunning. Every character, you're like, oh my god, they're in it. Like Scarlett Johansson turns up and I was like, what? I don't remember her being in it. Andy Serkis,
David Bowie,
David Bowie, yeah.
Bowie. I love it. I think he's so, so good. though I can recognize why people might find it distracting having, you know, David Bowie as Tesla. I think it's amazing though. I really, really love this film. I think it was a lot of fun. You know, the magic of Nolan's filmmaking here. It's a really fun watch. What do you think, Matt?
I love this as well. Like, kind of great performances. Great to see kind of Bale and Jackman sort of going head to head in this way. I love like kind of what you're saying. There's kind of so much to it. And I think this is true of all of Nolan's films where there's kind of no fat and he just gets so much in there. But the kind of Tesla in a way is almost like a sort of subplot. But that stuff's just so kind of fascinating and interesting. And then also it's actually really dark as well. It's really kind of dark at the end. Yeah, big fan of The Prestige.
It's one of those films that really rewards second viewings as well, because there's so much going on that you don't realise the first time you're watching. Like, I remember rewatching it the second time, and there's that moment, because spoilers for The Prestige if you haven't seen it yet. Obviously, Christian Bale's characters are brothers, twin brothers, which explains how he's able to do the transporting man. But there's that moment where Rebecca Hall's character, who's the wife of one of the brothers, says something like, "Oh, you don't love me today."
Yeah.
I remember watching that the first time and just thinking, oh, he's just been an asshole today.
Yeah.
But it's not. It's the wrong brother. It's like, oh, it's so clever in that way, the way it layers those illusions in and just puts it all there in plain sight. And you don't even realize it until you know the secret. And I'll just add as well, I really love the sci-fi twist at the end as well. Like, having said that Interstellar went one step too far with its sci-fi weirdness at the end, I really like that there's actual science fiction and magic in this film at the end. It just felt like a real surprise and shock, and it just absolutely delighted me.
Yeah, there's that kind of marriage of the sort of practical illusion side that you were talking about, but then, yeah, also that it goes into kind of hard sci-fi in that way as well. So that was The Prestige at number six. And so we're moving into the top half now, and at number five, it's this one.
He's here.
Who?
The Batman.
God, that must be destroyed.
Gotham isn't beyond saving.
Just hold on.
Guy dresses up like a bat, clearly has issues.
So that was, of course, Batman Begins. And the title sums this one up pretty nicely. It's an origin story for Batman. It's quite hard to explain how excited I was by the idea of Batman Begins when it was announced, because it was like the director of Memento tackling like my favorite pop culture character and starring one of my favorite actors, Christian Bale. I don't know if it's truly fair to call it a prequel, because I guess it's more of a reboot, but it goes right back to Batman's origins and looks at how he became the protector of Gotham in this really granular way, where the tech is all kind of grounded in a sort of conceivable reality. And it still has some really operatic moments, but it is grounded in this reality, which, to be honest, when I was younger, that was a lot of the appeal of Batman. It captures those twin appeals, which is the sort of symbolic fear that Batman sort of inspires in his enemies. But also, you felt he actually could do this if he had enough money, because he wasn't superhuman. It was just kind of grappling hooks and cool gadgets. So yeah, this film, we basically, in a time-jumping way, we follow Bruce Wayne from kind of childhood tragedy to life on the streets to kind of building up the Batcave and assembling all his wonderful toys, while at the same time facing the threats of the Scarecrow, played by Cillian Murphy, and Ra's al Ghul, who played ultimately by Liam Neeson. Yeah, so that's Batman Begins. It's number five. High on the list, guys. Does it warrant this placement?
I think so. I have a small confession to make, in that the first time I saw this film, I actually didn't like it. I think my expectations going into this film were completely different from what Nolan gives you. You know, I grew up on Tim Burton's Batman, and to a lesser extent, Joel Schumacher's Batman and Adam West's Batman. And seeing what Nolan did was just totally anathema to what I thought Batman was, because I think at this point I'd barely read any of the comics as well. But, you know, in subsequent years, I've watched it many, many times, and I now feel like an absolute fool forever not liking it, because it's clearly absolutely amazing.
I liked it a lot on first viewing, but I don't think I loved it as much as I expected, partly because I had a terrible cinema experience with, like, it was just me and a friend, and then a couple with a baby there, and the baby was just sort of walking around and sort of crying the whole time. So that was sort of off-putting. And I saw it again like a week later, and I must have seen it at least five more times since then, and just every time I kind of liked it a bit more, really. And I'm always impressed at just how kind of tight it is, and how, again, how just lean, and there's just no kind of wastage. There's no kind of, you know, stopping to repeat anything for the people at the back. It just kind of gets straight into it. And again, it has this sort of quite daring narrative structure jumping through time for a big blockbuster tentpole film. Yeah, I really love it. How about you, Jack?
Every film going forward is, you know, five star for me. This is just one of the incredible origin stories. You know, it never really strikes me as a superhero film, I guess. You know, even though Batman is obviously kind of one of the quintessential superheroes, it just feels like this, you know, weird detective movie in a way, with Bruce doing some, you know, stalking around. I don't know, it's hard to explain, because I do really, really, really love this film. And I think that the grittiness and the darkness that, you know, Nolan brings to the genre and this character, it works so perfectly. And it feels like, you know, how did they do Batman without this beforehand? The villain, Ra's al Ghul, he's so good in it. I really like Liam Neeson in this film. I think, you know, the final act, even though it's perhaps not as bombastic as, you know, the latter Batman films he's done, it still feels, you know, big, and gives us a nice look at Gotham as they're on the train going round as well. And it's kind of this really nasty plan that he has in place. Christian Bale's really good in it. Sometimes I'm not his biggest fan, but I think he is really, really great in this movie. So yeah, I feel like there's been a lot said about this movie and I can't really add much, because I just really enjoy it.
Yeah. I was just going to say, to add to what Jordan said as well, you almost forget that Batman was kind of cinematically disgraced at this point as well. Like, it'd been in the doghouse since Batman and Robin. So
Batman and Robin has its fans, come on.
But, you know, cinematic at least, we'd lost a bit of faith in Batman. So it was kind of on the back foot to start with. So the fact that it ended up being so good and sort of revitalizing Batman to sort of such a degree is just, yeah, all the more impressive.
Yeah. I mean, having, you know, revisited The Dark Knight Returns and Batman Year One, the comics afterwards, I think Nolan and David Goyer, the screenwriter, did absolutely the right thing in taking it back to, you know, those 80s era of really gritty Batman comics. And the fact that we hadn't really had a proper Batman origin story on screen at that point. I mean, you get a bit of it in, you know, Tim Burton's 89 Batman, with the Joker turning out to be the man that killed Batman's parents. But this was a film that really delved deep into the psychology of a person who would put on a bat suit and try to intimidate criminals in Gotham in that way. And I just love the fact that it also explores the idea of escalation and what would happen in reaction to someone putting on a costume and fighting crime. Like, of course, criminals would also start doing the same. And the fact that, it, you know, the supervillain in The Scarecrow, he's not a mystical figure. He uses toxins and hallucinogens, and everything has some kind of basis in reality, even though, you know, in many ways it's unreal. But the fact that you could believe in it was what separated it from previous Batman films for me.
And like you say, I like the fact you get this great origin story and then they leave that there, so when you get the sequels, you know, you've had that experience, but they don't just kind of revisit his parents being killed every time. That's one of the sort of great things it got right, I felt. So
the one thing that it gets wrong for me is, with all due respect, I think Katie Holmes is slightly miscast as Rachel. I think they saw that and corrected that in the sequel, even though I think she dropped out for scheduling reasons or something. But for me, she's a slight weak link in the cast. And it always annoyed me in Batman Begins that they call him Ra's al Ghul, because his name is actually pronounced Ra's al Ghul. But they call him Ra's in Dark Knight Rises because, of course, he's not the real Ra's.
So it all makes sense in the
end. Yeah, I thought that was genius. A great bit of retconning.
Okay, so a very worthy number five there, Batman Begins. And at number four, it's a survival story.
Where are we going?
Dunkirk.
I'm not going back.
We or they will die.
You're weekend sailors, not the bloody Navy.
You should be at home.
There's no hiding from this, son. We have a job to do.
Turn it around!
We shall fight on the beaches.
shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall never surrender.
We shall never surrender.
So that, of course, was Dunkirk. Jack, what do we need to know about Dunkirk?
Well, Dunkirk, it's set in 1940. It sees some British soldiers trying to get home from France during the war after they've been put on the back foot by the Germans. And one of those people is Harry Styles, you know, who just tries to get back and is basically just trying to survive. But there are three timelines kind of intersecting with each other. Another one of those is the boats trying to get from the UK to France to try and help these boys get home. So after the call out goes to, you know, all the boats to go travel over, we follow Barry Keoghan and Mark Rylance's boat as they travel over. And it's not a good journey over. Everything does not go well, to say the least. And then finally, there's the third timeline, which is the planes coming over to help as well. And we follow Tom Hardy's character as he flies and shoots down some Germans who are trying to stop our boats coming over. So yeah, there's a lot going on. It's one of Nolan's shorter films, and it's, at least for me, it's definitely his most intense. Mm. Yeah, I saw this at the IMAX, and the whole time my heart was pounding. You know, you have this incredible soundtrack, Hans Zimmer. It's like this ticking clock the whole time, and you just feel like, oh Christ, this is a lot. And I know that, you know, going into Nolan's filmmaking, but he tried to do this, it's called like The Shepherd's Tone. Yeah. And it's just this idea of just everything's escalating. And, you know, at the moment one scene kind of reaches a high, it goes to the next scene. It starts just rising again and again, and everything's just keeps escalating. The soundtrack does exactly the same using The Shepherd's Tone. And it had me sweating. How about you guys? Mm.
Yeah, and that sort of narrative structure that you mentioned, the three sort of separate timelines, is, I think it's one of the most elegant that Nolan's done of all his kind of, you know, tricky timelines. And it must have been so kind of complicated to conceive it, but then it just plays out so elegantly on screen, and it's just so intuitive to follow. Yeah, I basically agree with everything you said. Even though it's such a huge scale, it feels very stripped back. It's just so intense for the whole running time. It, as you say, one of his shortest, and it couldn't really be much longer because, you know, you can't really have your stomach in knots for that long. But what do you think, Jordan?
I remember when this film was announced and I was just absolutely baffled because, you know, Nolan had been making genre films for the best part of a decade at this point. And the fact that he was going to make a film about Dunkirk, about World War II, just seemed anathema to everything I thought he was as a filmmaker. But once you've seen it, you absolutely see why he would want to make this film. It's almost like the in sequence of Saving Private Ryan, to stretch out over 90 minutes. Like, you're just thrown in the middle of the action. It's relentless. It puts you in a place that other war movies really haven't for that extended period of time. And the fact that there's really not much of a story. The story is they have to survive until help arrives. That's it. You never really get to know any of these Joes. They're all practically nameless. But at the same time, you're deeply invested in their fates because you can't help but empathize with what they're going through because it's such an intense, harrowing situation. I think it's a remarkable film. Like Jack, I saw it at the IMAX. I was actually at the premiere for this one, the Royal Premiere, where William and Kate showed up as well, so that was quite nice. But I later saw it at the BFI IMAX in 70mm, which was, you know, Nolan's preferred format for it. And it just felt like the whole film was reverberating through my body. I just remember coming out just feeling like exhausted, like I'd been through something myself instead of just sitting on my ass for 90 minutes.
It's interesting because I know quite a few people who aren't the biggest fan of this film because it doesn't quite have like an emotional heart to it, you know, that you don't really like any of the characters too much or anything. And as much as we're sympathetic towards them because we recognize the struggle, there are no personalities in this movie so much. But I think in a way that's not really the point of this film. It is an experience. Yeah, it's like a roller coaster ride in many ways, you know, that kind of heart poundingness to it. So I find it absolutely stunning. And obviously, like, the cinematography in this movie is incredible. I love especially the scenes with Tom Hardy when we're flying over top and we see the vast ocean, and it helps just create the hopelessness almost of just trying to bridge over from the UK to go save these lads. Yeah. I love it.
And Nolan's commitment to shooting things for real as much as possible really pays off in this film. I think, you know, for a long time we've seen war films with, you know, CG planes and CG explosions, but the fact that you can tell every bit of sand that lands on Finn Whitehead's head is real just makes it feel all the more visceral. And the fact that they had like real Spitfires flying over the channel is just remarkable. Like, it's an unbelievable feat of filmmaking.
I do think there are some great little character moments in there as well, particularly that perhaps my favourite in terms of characters is Mark Rylance's character. Just there's something about him, even though he's kind of so stoic and everything sort of paired back, you know, as the film goes on, you do just get these bits more from him and just his relationship with Cillian Murphy and what happens to Barry Keoghan.
The sort of British stiff upper lip stuff really pays off when, you know, the lip starts to crack a little bit. You know who's also a very big fan of this film?
Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah, you know, a shout out to his podcast on the Rewatchables if you want to hear his thoughts, where he talks about his favourite film of the 2010s, Dunkirk.
Yes, definitely worth a listen. Yep, so that was a worthy number four, Dunkirk there. And moving into the top three now with...
We create the world of the dream. We bring the subject into that dream, and they fill it with their secrets.
Then you break in and steal it.
Well, it's not strictly speaking legal. It's called Inception. I'm ready. I think I found a way home. And this last job, that's how I get there.
That's Inception at number three. We're in the top three now. Jordan, talk us through Inception.
Yeah, so Inception, obviously an unbelievable film. Nolan's first film after The Dark Knight, so came with insane expectations. Leonardo DiCaprio stars as Cobb. He's effectively a dream robber. He enters people's dreams and he steals information from them. But the inception of the title refers to the fact that his latest assignment is not to steal something from someone, it's to put an idea into someone's head. This was once thought impossible, but Cobb knows he can do it because he's done it before.
Whoa.
So it's effectively a dream heist movie. And again, like many of Nolan's best films, it's incredibly complex and it deals with these remarkable imaginative ideas where you're traveling through the dream layers of Cillian Murphy's sort of tech CEO, which allows him to do some incredible visual things. You know, famously, this has the rotating corridor sequence, basically a mini Bond movie in the middle of it, where they assault this like ski lodge in the middle of the Alps somewhere. But it's just a really smart, really inventive, cerebral sci-fi actioner, which is one of those films that really gives the audience a lot of credit that, you know, he's not holding your hand all the way through it. He's really sort of expecting you to keep up with the story that he's telling. And I think that's why, one of the reasons why it resonated with audiences so much, because it felt like these films weren't being made and really still aren't being made by anyone except Christopher Nolan.
We should say that Inception was Total Film's film of the decade when we kind of had that poll at the end of last year, and obviously just been re-released in cinemas ahead of Tenet. There still clearly is a lot of love for it, and yeah, understandably, I'd say. And I also think this is one that's more emotional than people give Nolan credit for. Not only the stuff with kind of Cobb and his wife, Mal, played by Marion Cotillard, but
Mal,
also,
as they like to say,
Mal.
Mal.
It really gets to me when you get that kind of final scene with Cillian Murphy when, it, you know, in that kind of final layer when he goes into his sort of dad's bedside. It's a weird one because obviously on one level it's just not real, so I kind of feel bad for him because he has this catharsis that's just entirely fraudulent. So that kind of adds an extra dimension to the kind of sadness I feel of just seeing this father kind of, you know, say to his son, you know, that he was not disappointed in him and was just disappointed that he tried to be like him, and he's got the windmill and the save by the bit.
Pinwheel. Yeah, I rewatched Inception this week and I was struck by how much that scene is exactly like the scene in 2001. Where he walks into the room once he's gone, you know, through the vortex or whatever,
a lighting from the floor.
I just didn't remember that at all. That is a wonderful scene, and so many of the moments that became hallmarks for Christopher Nolan's career you can find in this film. Like I mentioned earlier, the rotating corridor is just an absolutely magnificent set piece. So simple but so effective and so just unreal. Like, what Nolan does so well, going back to Dunkirk, is not relying so heavily on visual effects. He's able to achieve things that other films just can't, even with millions and millions of dollars worth of CGI. There's an effect which you just don't get if you don't do these things for real. And I think Nolan realizes that, and he's one of the few filmmakers who can still do it.
And no matter how many times you've seen them like fighting in the corridor and kind of like sliding up the walls and stuff, even when you kind of know how it's done with a fixed position camera and everything.
Yeah.
And the rig, your brain just can't comprehend it. And you just see this kind of dream world where kind of the laws of gravity aren't applying.
One of the things that Inception really hammered home for me as well is the fact that Christopher Nolan really knows how to end the film. Like so many of his films have just remarkable endings, and Inception is one of my absolute favorites. Like I love the ambiguity of the spinning top at the end, and you know, Hans Zimmer's music sort of swelling. It really sends you out on a high, and it's hard to underestimate how important that is. When a film has a flat ending, it can dampen the whole experience for you, but Nolan acknowledges that arguably your most memorable moment has to be your final shot. And for me, Inception ends on probably the best bit, which is quite an achievement.
And if a film like that is number three, what is going to be at number two and one? So at number two, it's this one.
I guess I've already told you about my condition.
Funny every time I see you.
You don't remember where you've been or what you've just done.
I can't make new memories. Everything just fades.
What's the last thing you do remember?
My wife.
That's sweet.
Dying.
You really want to get this guy, don't you?
My wife deserves vengeance.
When you find this guy, what are you going to do?
I'm going to kill him.
Somebody's got to pay, Lenny. Somebody always pays.
That was Memento, of course. What a film. So Memento is Nolan's second film as a director, but really it was his true calling card. And if Following sort of showed some of the potential of what he could do with a micro budget, this showed what he could do with a bigger, although still indie-sized budget, and with professional actors as well. And it showed just how ambitious and daring he was with narratives. You can call it a film noir, but everything you kind of expect from that genre is kind of turned on its head. And the narrative structure is kind of really closely intertwined with character. So the film plays out in reverse order, effectively. We start at the last scene, which has Leonard Shelby, who's played by Guy Pearce, killing a man he believes has killed his wife. And then each scene jumps back and ends just before where the previous one began. So in the next scene, we see what happened just before this, and so on and so on. And there's also this black and white frame story you get, where in between those scenes, you see Leonard speaking to an unknown caller from a motel room. And we're not entirely sure where this is happening. And it goes on from there. And eventually these two threads link up. And I actually rewatched this film ahead of this podcast, and it still holds up exceptionally well. And it's obviously much smaller in scale compared to the type of films that Nolan is making these days. But it still just feels essentially Nolan, and it's just so clever and like his best. It's so thrilling and complex, but at the same time really intuitive to follow. And I just love the way that it's structured. It has these kind of micro twists like littered throughout from scene to scene, so it's kind of constantly wrong footing you. And yeah, I absolutely love this film. This was one of my kind of gateway films into really loving films, I think, because I saw it when I was about 16. I remember seeing reviews and thinking, wow, that sounds like really good, this sounds like someone to watch. And then also just seeing those images of Guy Pearce and his body kind of covered in tattoos, where he's marking up all these clues permanently on his body, was kind of really arresting. And just that made me think, oh, I must need to watch it. And then when I saw it, I felt so just like, oh my god, yeah, it just felt like one of those game-changing films for me personally. What do you guys think of Memento?
I feel like I still haven't worked out this film, because I'm thinking back to it now and I'm like, crikey, all that stuff did happen. You know, it's a thrilling watch. It's been a while since I've seen it, but I just remember thinking Guy Pearce was so excellent in it. You're just questioning everything all the time. And I think this is such an amazing case of how Nolan gives you just enough information to have something to go on. So your brain is just firing on all cylinders the whole time you're watching it, while at the same time, you kind of just have to give into the movie and just let it show you what's happening. And, you know, I really, really enjoy this. I also realized I didn't say anything during our Inception chat.
Sorry, Jack, we excluded you.
I know. I think I was just enjoying listening to you guys talk about it, because it is my number one Nolan film, I think, because it's such a big scale. And this one, you know, Matt's right, you know, it brings everything back, and it's very much, rather than the huge set pieces and stuff, it's very much just about the idea and kind of keeping you going and really honing in on Guy Pearce's character and using him to kind of draw you along. You know, if it wasn't for him being quite so, you know, charismatic and intriguing, you know, this film could have so easily have fallen apart. You know, other people, other directors have tried narrative techniques like this and just flopped completely, yet Nolan still does it in a way that it just works and it all ties together so well.
It can feel like showboating, can't it, if people try to go too far with kind of tricks and things like that. But for this, it just feels like it just is so right for that story. And again, it has that classic Nolan thing that we've said about quite a few of these films where you just immediately want to watch it again.
You know, everyone acknowledges Nolan's an exceptional director, but I almost feel like he doesn't get enough credit for being an extraordinary screenwriter as well. Like his Memento
Oscar nominated
script,
here.
Yeah. You know, co-written with Jonathan Nolan, his brother, who obviously went on to create Westworld. It's one of the best scripts of the 2000s, of the noughties. It's absolutely remarkable. Like, I just can't, a slight spoiler for the Tenet review that's coming up, but I almost just can't fathom a mind that could conceive this and execute it in a way that it's even remotely coherent. It just seems so complex. It just seems like rocket science to me. It's a remarkable bit of writing. And the fact that he has the chops as a director to back that up, it's the reason why he's gone on to be one of the, you know, the great modern directors.
It does make the choice to do Insomnia after this, you know, a remake, and then even to do, you know, Batman. It makes both those choices seem so weird, because he obviously is, you know, so gifted as a writer and creator of an original story, that doing something like a remake and, you know, a superhero film, Batman, who's been done so many times before as well, makes it so odd. Yet also why those films work so well, because it is such a odd pairing and a thrilling one at that as well.
And Memento is really the film that, you know, for us as viewers at least, it's where we first got our real introduction to Christopher Nolan's fascination with chronology and temporal storytelling. You know, it's something that's continued throughout his career. He's explored the idea of time in various different multifaceted ways, but here is probably one of the most effective ways he's done it until Tenet, because it just works so effectively on film. Like, I don't know if a story like this would work half as well in a novel or in a TV show. It's just a perfect 1 hour 45 minute movie.
That was Memento. So we're coming to the number one spot now. So just to recap, the list so far has been 10 Following, 9 Insomnia, 8 The Dark Knight Rises, 7 Interstellar, 6 The Prestige, 5 Batman Begins, 4 Dunkirk, 3 Inception, and of course we just had 2 Memento, which leads us to the number one.
You've changed things. Forever. There's no going back. See, to them, you're just a freak. Like me.
So you know by now, that's The Dark Knight. Jack, tell us why The Dark Knight is our number one.
It's hard to sum up how amazing this film is. I do adore this so much. But, well, I'll start with the premise. Obviously, it's Batman. Following Batman Begins, he's kind of more established as being the Dark Knight. And this time around, his foe is Heath Ledger's Joker, who basically has Gotham by the balls in this film. You know, it starts off with this incredible bank heist, and the Joker's just kind of causing chaos here. He suddenly infiltrates the underground of Gotham. So there's also this other story going on where Harvey Dent, he's seen as Gotham's protector in many ways, but not the same one as Batman. Well, actually, he does kind of come out and say he is Batman, doesn't he? Christ, this movie, so many layers. But he's trying to get elected for office, but then he gets caught up in the Joker's actions and half his face gets blown off. Spoilers, he becomes Two-Face. And so Bruce Wayne kind of, he goes up against the Joker and he tries to sort out this man who's just trying to cause chaos. And halfway through, Batman has to make a deadly choice, which kind of sends him spiraling as well. So there's a lot going on in this movie. It's action-packed. It's Nolan at his most thrilling. It's just so watchable. It's so I don't know, it's just incredible. And it's all grounded by this incredible performance by Heath Ledger as the Joker, this character who has no origins. You know, we don't really understand why he's doing things. He's just crazy and wants to cause chaos. He's one of the, if not the greatest villain in cinema. You know, he's so fantastic.
I mean, I completely agree. It's one of my favourite performances ever at Heath Ledger as the Joker. And then also just the fact that it's one of those perfect sequels in the sense that everything's set up in the first one when you just go running straight into it in the second one with all ready to go. And then the fact that you just get like great set piece after great set piece. And this was, of course, like the first time Nolan properly started using the IMAX cameras as he does for kind of several key sequences here, like the opening heist you mentioned. But then there's also just like the famous truck flip, but the whole chase that leads up to that and the bat pod that we see for the first time in this film. And just, I love that whole showdown you get at the end with Batman and the Joker. It just feels so kind of classically Batman, the way there's these kind of games the Joker's playing with it. But yeah, it just feels so kind of epic and believable and sort of thrilling at the same time. It's a tough one to call because, like, as I say, there's not much in it between these top eight Nolan films for me. But if I was backed into a corner, I think this is what I would put as my number one. I think it's a worthy number one. Jordan, what do you think?
Yeah. I mean, it feels like we're always talking about The Dark Knight because, yeah. Of course, if you listen to our top 10 superhero films episode, The Dark Knight was number one on that as well. Spoilers. But it's for a good reason because it's such an incredible film. There's practically nothing wrong with it. My one small criticism, which I hold to this day, is that the Joker must be like psychic or something, because some of the plans he puts into action, there's no way you could predict like he would be in the same prison cell as, you know, the guy who has the mobile phone bomb in his stomach or whatever it is. There's a few dramatic licenses going on here, but apart from that, it's pretty much a perfect movie for me. And a lot of that, you know, is on the shoulders of Heath Ledger. You know, we've spoken about him a lot, but it's for good reason, because taking on that character, such an iconic character thanks to Jack Nicholson, being able to reinvent it and doing something just as remarkable is such an achievement. And I'm not surprised that every Joker since has sort of taken a lot more from Heath Ledger than they have from Jack Nicholson. I mean, you can see much more of Heath Ledger in Joaquin Phoenix and Jared Leto's Jokers than you can in Jack Nicholson's Joker. But he's an incredible character. I love everything about his design. You want to know how I got these scars, the ratty costumes, the just horrible greasy hair. Just, it all works for that character. But then I really like what they do with Batman in this film as well. I love the new bat suit. The bat pods is so freaking cool. It has some interesting stuff in there about, you know, surveillance and what the role of an overseer or protector should be. He does actually try to layer in ideas and social criticism and all that kind of stuff. So it's really brilliant.
And I love the fact that unexpectedly the main kind of arc of the film was Harvey Dent / Two-Face, that you kind of initially see him as this sort of supporting character, but really he's the one who has that arc that sort of carries us through the film.
The soul of Gotham is the arc, right? Because Batman, he can save Gotham, but he can only do so much. He can't have one man stopping every criminal that comes into Gotham. Like, he recognizes there has to be more. And I love the fact that the film recognizes that as well. If you were coming at it from a really cynical perspective, if you were like a toy manufacturer, you'd be like, just make Batman the hero. Why do we need anyone else? But it totally makes sense. And I think Nolan acknowledges, you know, Nolan's not a filmmaker who makes films that are going to be made into toys. Like, he wants to do something more with it. And I think that's what makes it special as well.
That was The Dark Knight, number one in our list of Nolan movies. So thanks everyone for sticking with us. And now is the time for our spoiler-free review of Nolan's latest film, Tenet.
That test you passed? Not everybody does. Welcome to the afterlife.
To do what I do, I need some idea of the threat we face.
As I understand it, we're trying to prevent World War III.
Nuclear holocaust?
No. Something worse.
All I have for you is a word. Tenet.
That is Tenet. The embargo's lifted now, and Jordan and I have seen it. And now there's going to be a spoiler special spoiler cast coming very soon once you guys have had a chance to see the film. But for now, it's going to be strictly spoiler free, and we're not going to go into anything sort of plot wise that you won't have either seen in trailers or that isn't already out there. And Jordan, you've reviewed this film for Total Film, so please set it up for us.
Yeah, definitely spoiler free, because Jack hasn't seen it, so I know he's not going to be happy if I slip in little spoilers.
No, thank you. I am dead excited for this film and don't want anything spoiled. So, but I'm very excited to hear what you think of it.
Yeah, so Tenet is finally here. This stars Black Klansman's John David Washington. He plays the protagonist. I'm not going to say any more than that. If you've seen the prologue that screened before The Rise of Skywalker last year, you'll know that he's sort of an American agent with a particular set of skills who's enlisted with a word and a gesture. Tenet. He's recruited to stop Kenneth Branagh's truly odious Anglo-Russian oligarch Andrei Sator from basically unleashing World War III. Quite how Sator plans to achieve this, that really deserves to be discovered on screen. And to be 100% honest, I'm not sure I could explain it in words, even if I tried. But it's no spoiler to say that it involves the inversion of time, which is this ingenious central conceit that pushes Nolan's, you know, multifaceted, career-long exploration of temporal storytelling to its logical and really inspired extreme. And for me, this was a film that was really sort of cut from the same whip-smart, sharply tailored cloth as Inception. It's effectively a men on a mission type of movie, which revolves around this complex, ingenious central idea, which you spend most of the film trying to keep up with and trying to understand. And it doesn't have the emotional angle of something like an Interstellar or the kind of character work you get in something like The Prestige. But what it does have in spades are absolutely remarkable set pieces, really sort of career highlight set pieces. I don't know. What did you think, Matt?
Yeah, I agree that it's going to be no surprise to people that I love this film, obviously. It was kind of engineered for me to like it, I think. But basically, it feels like pure unadulterated Nolan in a way, because I agree with what you mean with the Inception is the closest comparison you would make, yeah, because of that mission element and the sharp suits and the incredible set pieces and the kind of staggering concept. But there's threads of a lot of other of Nolan's films in here as well. So there's just plenty that will kind of you'll recognise as kind of themes and concerns of his when you watch it, if you're a big fan of his previous work. And it just is also littered with just these kind of astounding, largely practical set pieces that, again, I won't go into too much detail, but you'll have seen glimpses of in trailers. But there's several kind of like hairs on the back of your neck standing up moments. And what I loved about it, and again, why we're kind of keeping this spoiler free for Jack and everyone else listening, is there's so much fun in kind of discovering it in the cinema as well. Like, there's plenty of stuff that you haven't seen in trailers. There's a lot of kind of, you know, surprises and a lot of sort of fresh things in there. And like Inception, when you remember when you kind of first saw that at the cinema, and so much of the fun and the joy in it was just having this kind of concept unfold and just seeing how the rules of that world work. And so that's kind of one of the real thrills of this film as well. And like, as we said, with pretty much all these films, it's definitely one where immediately afterwards you're going to want to watch it again. So I kind of advise just booking two tickets in advance, just book for like the showing the next day as well, because you're going to want to go back in there. And it is probably the most complicated sort of, you know, narrative timeline games that Nolan's played so far. Would you agree, Jordan?
Yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely. As I said earlier, I rewatched Inception this week, and what I was struck with watching that, you know, for the first time in a number of years, is that Nolan handles the very complex ideas in that film really elegantly. And at no point do you ever feel lost. You always feel like you're in a safe pair of hands in that film. I think quite deliberately in Tenet, there are moments where you will not have any idea what's going on. It's a very challenging film in that respect. Practically until the final shot of the film, you don't get an appreciation for the whole picture. So it's very smart, as Matt says, to book a second screening not too long after. But I think that's sort of part of its genius. And if you're willing to give yourself over to Nolan's vision and fully trust what he's doing with this film, you'll find it incredibly rewarding. And it's amazing to me that he's done this with a, you know, a 200 million blockbuster. I was talking to a friend about this and I was sort of comparing it to Primer. Like, it feels like a $200 million remake of Primer in some ways, where you're like, what the hell is going on a lot of the time? But this is countered by the fact that in action sequences, there's an incredible sense of clarity. You never have any doubt about what characters are doing, who they have to stop, what they have to do to achieve their mission. You're not confused in that way. It's more big picture stuff. But it really pays off.
And also, there's, I'm probably going to misquote the line slightly, but Clemence Posey's character says something early on along the lines of, don't think, feel, got to just go with the flow, effectively. It seems very fitting that that comes early on, because it's almost like, it is one of those things, because the narrative is so kind of propulsive as well, and it's so, there's so much momentum, that even if you're not 100% grasping, you know, everything about the concept, you're very much invested and you're very much being pulled along with it. And it's just so kind of exciting that, or for me anyway, even when you know you couldn't necessarily draw an exact diagram of everything that's going on, you're never sort of so lost that you disengage with the film. That's how I found it anyway.
I thought the dialogue and some of the character stuff in this film was actually quite fun. Like, it's got a real sense of humor that I was surprised about. Like, John David Washington's protagonist is just a lot of fun. This is a very mild spoiler, but there's a moment where he kind of gets into a fight. He just quips something about he's been waiting an hour for his hot sauce. And it just really tickled me. I just wasn't expecting it from a Christopher Nolan film where you'd actually have a real kind of zippy James Bond one-liner in there. So it is a lot of fun, even though, you know, you spend a lot of the film playing catch up with these incredibly complex ideas that Nolan's putting forward. It's still tons of fun as well. And we should say that Robert Pattinson's in this film as well. He's really good fun. I thought he was a really good advert for his Bruce Wayne. Like, he has this kind of sort of cocksure swagger about him. And he almost seems like a sort of trust fund baby, where he just seems like he's untouchable. But I really enjoyed him. And Kenneth Branagh, oh my God. Yeah. I mean, we've seen him play a Russian villain before, much less successfully in that Tom Clancy movie. But here, oh my God, he's so repulsive. He's utterly horrible. I'm sort of partially amazed that they got away with some of the stuff they do in a 12A. Like, he's up there with Heath Ledger's Joker in terms of like being genuinely quite scary. And some of the stuff he's involved with is like really quite upsetting and graphic, even though you don't see anything gory, his descriptions of it are really quite horrible.
Yeah, that was one of the biggest surprises for me, because especially as in real life, he's kind of one of the nicest guys in movies. And, he's just so menacing in this. He was really one of the standouts. And I could see, if we end up having awards this year, I could see him being in line for kind of supporting actor awards, because he really is great in this.
Yeah. But I mean, the thing that really stood out to me about this film, and it will be no surprise to anyone who, you know, saw Dunkirk, is it's just a real assault on the senses. It was shot predominantly in full frame 70mm IMAX film, and if you are able to go and see it in 70mm IMAX, I would absolutely recommend it. I'd say it looked absolutely astonishing. It sort of inspired more awe in me than most Hollywood blockbusters do, just with establishing shots of, like, you know, these incredible Italian cliff faces or these skyscrapers in Mumbai. I was just aghast. It's like just the most amazing kind of documentary footage you've ever seen in service of a 200 million action blockbuster. And then, of course, you have the set pieces that we've alluded to. There's one that, you know, has been well documented, which in fact you were on set to see being filmed, where a 747 plane crashes into a hangar for real, which, oh God, it's hard to describe, because it just absolutely blows your mind, especially in IMAX, because it's effectively life-size and you just can't believe what you're seeing. But that's really like basically an amuse-bouche for set pieces that come later. Like, that's kind of low-key compared to the kind of stuff he does later on. And I mean, like, as I said with, you know, his Memento script, I just couldn't believe that a human mind could sort of conceive and execute some of the stuff he does in this film. It's just so complex and so ingenious. It just really blew me away.
So Jack, on that note, have you got any spoiler-free questions for us that you sort of want to know,
grill
us, having not seen it yet?
I don't really want to know too much more about it. I feel like I've got a real sense of the film. I mean, it sounds insane. It sounds incredible. It sounds like James Bond, but with, you know, weird sci-fi timey twists with it. I'm very, very excited for that. It also sounds like you're going to be able to watch the film backwards and it would still make sense somehow. My question is, in the ranking we've just done, where would you put Tenet, do you think? I know you've only just seen it, so it might be hard to kind of, you know, with these films we've lived with for so long, but, you know, your initial gut reaction.
It's an exceptional piece of work. It feels a little too early for me to compare it to something, you know, his filmography to date. I've only seen it once, and I feel like I really need to see it a second time to fully appreciate it. And I do have some small issues with the film. I think the fact that it is so complex won't be to everyone's taste. It's not an easily digestible film. It's not, you know, a Marvel movie. It's something that you really have to invest in.
Like, if anyone just turns up to the cinema and is like just popping out to the toilet, just, you know, like focusing on their snacks or whatever, you
miss the first 10 minutes. Yeah, exactly. You've got no chance, basically. And I do have a slight issue with Elizabeth Debicki's character. She saw the partner of Kenneth Branagh's Sata. And for me, she was a tiny bit too much of a damsel. Like, she spends a lot of the film needing to be rescued, basically, which I was a little bit disappointed in. But apart from that, you know, there's not a lot in it. I don't know if it will crack my top five, but it will be very close.
Yeah, me and Jordan actually briefly had this discussion the other day, and it's just very tricky for me because on the one hand, it's at a disadvantage because I've spent so much time with these other films and rewatched them so much. But then it also has the bonus that because it feels so fresh and exciting, I'm tempted to say higher. So, like, I'm a bit hesitant to say right now just because I do feel like I need it to settle a little bit. It's worthy. It would be in my top eight where there's not much in it. It will become now a top nine where there's not much in it.
But, I mean, that's just a testament to him as a filmmaker, isn't it? Just how consistent he has been, you know, for the last 20 years as a filmmaker. And this is, in many ways, a culmination of his career to date. As we mentioned, it really takes his fascination with time in many forms to an extreme. And it's really only a film that he could make. It's only a film that he could get made. I mean, this film cost $200 million and every dollar is on the screen as far as I'm concerned. It's just amazing to me that he convinced people to give him that much money for this script because, you know, it's really not your typical summer blockbuster. It's really not an easy film. But for that, I absolutely commend it. And of course, you know, Tenet has been long delayed. It was supposed to come out in cinemas in July, but has been pushed back a number of times due to the coronavirus crisis. But it's actually coming out in cinemas next Wednesday, the 26th of August. This is a five-star film for me. You can read my five-star review online right now.
So that was our spoiler-free review of Tenet. If you're a fan of this podcast, please do rate it and subscribe it so you'll never miss an episode, including when we do our upcoming Tenet spoiler cast. And if you have any questions for that, do drop us a line at totalfilm@futurenet.com. And so now it's just time to say that, as always, there's 10% off Total Film subscriptions with the code INSIDETF at checkout at www.myfavoritemagazines.co.uk. Also, as well, I mean, what a week. Our brand new issue is also out now, featuring the new Candyman on the cover, which leads a massive horror special. So please do check that out as well. It's on shelves, real and digital now. And you can find out more about it and also read Jordan's full Tenet review at gamesradar.com/totalfilm. So yeah, so that's it from all of us now. So thanks very much for listening and bye.
Bye.
Bye.